The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Wednesday, January 1st, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Oh my gosh, Happy New Year, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. Boy, am I hungover. No, I'm not. I probably did nothing last night. I'm not. New Year's amateur hour, as far as I'm concerned. That's what I used to say back in the day. This is the best night. New Year's is the best night to go out and is to work. Back when I was in the hotel or restaurant catering business. Because you get the best tips, make a bunch of cash, watch a bunch of people make asses of themselves. Not a bad gig. But those days hopefully are behind me. Not quite as young as I used to be. I'm not going to sling the drinks, as they say, behind the bar. It's a young man's game. But we're here in 2020. It's the first time I've said that in reference to today's date. And I got it right. I thought I was going to say 2019. I didn't. I said 2020. So I'm pretty impressed with that. That bodes well for this year. We still have one more Best of 2019 episode to provide for you. Tomorrow, we are back live. Back live tomorrow, Thursday. This episode is, I just found this book fascinating and disturbing. the author, and I think he's one of the co-authors. He is Matthew Blackwell. He's associate professor of government at Harvard University. And he wrote a book, or co-authored a book, Deep Roots, How Slavery Still Shapes Southern Politics. It is fascinating and scary. The research that they have done and being able to measure politics, political outcomes, just based upon a metric that had to do with slaves and slave owners 200 some odd years ago or 150 years ago. I can't do the math. You can do the folks.
This was ancient history.
Ancient history.
As the Republicans say.
Yeah. And the fact is that even ancient history, they don't go back to that, but there was a comedy made about the Black Plague. I mean, stick around. Come for the how slavery still dictates our politics. But stay for the Black Plague also dictating our politics. It when you start to drill down upon this, like it makes some sense. There are ideas out there in psychology that characteristics, traits, dispositions travel through generations and take years and generations and generations to expunge and change. And when you think about it, it makes sense. I mean, it makes sense. Fascinating book. And we also still, even though it's 2020, we're still following our 2019 best of policy of giving you a free fun half. So it's your last chance to enjoy the free fun half. And then it's time for you to become a member in 2020. How's that for a New Year's resolution? I got a New Year's resolution that you're going to be able to fulfill so easy. Just go over to jointhemajorityreport.com. Plank down a couple of quarters and every day, not even 35 cents, become a member of this program, support independent media, support media. You know, you could support, Pod Save America or, Vox podcast or something like that. But, you know, the fact is they're all big moneyed corporate entities, and we are not. So your support makes it possible for this show to exist and to grow and to hopefully, create other shows, use it as a launch pad for other shows so that we can have more independent media out there, more perspectives on stuff. You know, we're never going to do a right-wing show. I'll be honest with you about that. We're never going to do a show, frankly, I don't think we're ever going to do a show that I would consider to be in any way to the right of us. So the idea around here is to do shows, you know, around where I am, and in terms of the politics, and to the left. And that's the project. So if you want to be a part of that, join themajorityreport.com. Join themajorityreport.com. Don't forget, you can listen to the AM Quickie, get your dose of lefty news headlines in the morning. AMQuickie.com. You can subscribe or you can get it through the app. Meantime, we will be back live tomorrow. And now, quick break, back with Matthew Blackwell, Deep Roots, How Slavery Still Shapes Southern Politics. Welcome back, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Matthew Blackwell. He is Associate Professor of Government at Harvard University, also one of the co-authors of Deep Roots, How Slavery Still Shapes Southern Politics, with Avedit Chiara and Maya Sen. Matthew, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's just start with the mission of the book was to answer the question, why is the United States particularly conservative on the issue of race, or why are there differing parts of the United States that seem to be? Was that basically it?
Yeah, I think we were kind of thinking about how to wrap our heads around the fact that, you know, of the advanced industrialized countries, the United States is kind of an outlier in terms of the conservativeness, and in particular that we have this kind of one region in the country that has historically been and continues to be fairly conservative, and that's the South. And, you know, it doesn't take a lot to recognize that the South also has kind of an intense history of things like slavery and racialized violence and things like that. And we kind of were setting out to think about, well, could we kind of systematically think about how those two things are linked? Is there some deep historical reason, not just about, you know, candidates and polls and you know, campaign advertisements, but there's something deeper in the history of America that kind of has led to the broad political cultures that we see in the United States.
Implied in that is that our politics are somewhat racialized. Political issues that are not necessarily on their face racial, in fact, are to some degree.
Yeah, I think, there's evidence, you know, not just in our book, but in elsewhere in political science that kind of shows how it's the case that, you know, when we think about redistribution in this country, a lot of people tend to think about, you know, where is the money going to come from and who is it going to go to? And the notions of, you know, the from and to tend to get caught up in a lot of ideas about race and racial groups. And so the idea that the kind of redistribution itself, kind of the core, maybe the cornerstone political issue in the United States, gets wrapped up in, you know, are the groups that are perceived to go into beginning this redistribution deserving of that in some way? And when those groups kind of, when that kind of thinking latches onto race as one of these groups, it can really shape how people think about redistribution and really shape a lot of people's opposition to redistribution, even in times when it would perhaps even help their own personal interests.
And so you set out to sort of answer this question as to why there's this type of divergence. What is, just define for us this notion of behavioral path dependence. What for lay people, what does that mean?
Yeah, so the basic idea behind this behavioral path dependence is the idea that regions or areas of the country that have certain kinds of institutions, be they economic institutions or political institutions or some combination of the two, those institutions can kind of set different localities down a path in the way and shape the kind of the behaviors and the beliefs and the actions of the people that live in those areas. And those kinds of behaviors and actions and beliefs can outlast the initial institutions that kind of the beliefs are responding to. So, you know, we can see this sometimes where it's no longer necessarily just reacting to the environment, but now those beliefs kind of take on a life of their own, even though they don't necessarily have any place in the current kind of institutional structure. And so we're kind of thinking about that in the context of slavery itself in the South, and how kind of a lot of beliefs and attitudes that were built up in response to slavery, and especially in response to its aftermath, you can kind of see the incentives for why they were developed at the time that they were developed. But what we show is that those things tend to outlast all of those institutions by a long way, even after things like slavery, Jim Crow, and have been formally abolished in the South. We still see some kind of lingering behaviors and attitudes from those eras in these localities.
This is sort of, I guess, I mean, there's like a parallel concept, right, in psychology and within the context of family. I mean, just for instance, my great grandparents, were very, very uptight about, all of us having our passports, because they had an experience where they had to get out of Germany rather quickly, or Depression era folks being, concerned about money, and this is passed down generation to generation, three or four generations later, you can still have people who are really uptight about money or about their passports. I mean, it's somewhat analogous to that on some level.
Yeah, and so, I mean, if you think about, and obviously some of that might be genetic about the variations in people, but we also have certain issues where, it's going to be the case that, the way that you come to view the world is somehow shaped by the world around you as you're growing up, this kind of idea of childhood socialization, that, the way that your family talks about money, for instance, can shape the way that you're going to view money as an adult, or the way that, in our instance, it's the way that race is discussed, the way that race is contextualized, the way that people talk about, kind of interracial relationships, all of those things can't but impact the way that you think about race moving forward. And even if there's a change in the context of race, obviously the context of race in, say, the 1940s in the U.S. South is very different than the context today. I mean, those are just different time periods with different kind of levels of, say, obvious institutional racism. But it may still shape the way you think about it and the kind of where you fall along the spectrum in terms of, having different views about race today.
Okay, so you have this theory that that our politics today, not totally but largely, when we look at these maps, and I think maybe by now people have seen sort of these overlay maps that in some extent come out of your research here, but things that happened, that the way that the institution of slavery grew in the United States is predictive of basically how you'd vote today.
Yeah.
Like, if that's the theory, then what? Just tell us the cities that you decided to look at and why those two were sort of the way to test this theory.
Yeah, so we the kind of two example cities that we kind of focus on, especially in the book, are kind of evocative of the kind of two regions of the South broadly. And the first is that we talk about is in terms of is Greenwood, Mississippi, and that's a place where it's one point, there's a sign in the outskirts of town that says Greenwood, cotton capital of the world. And it was just a kind of a powerhouse in terms of cotton productivity in the late 19th and early 20th century, and it was real kind of embedded in the Mississippi Delta and all of those things, and that has a kind of large African American population that's a remnant of that, to some extent a remnant of that era. And so we see this as one of these places that was kind of deep in the heart of the slave culture and the enslaved areas of the South. And we compare that to Asheville, North Carolina, where an area that is kind of in the upcountry, that is really rugged area, has a certain perception today, but it is was never a good place for growing cotton in the 19th century, and never had a serious kind of foothold of slavery back in the pre-Civil War era. And we kind of contrast these two places because, you know, neither of these places are particularly liberal. Both are we would, I think, you know, generally say are conservative relative to the rest of the country. But it's certainly the case that the difference between the politics of these two areas is pretty dramatic today. And one of the in Greenwood is still extremely conservative. You know, we estimate that very, very few white people that live in the county that Greenwood is in voted for Barack Obama in 2008, for instance. Whereas we you know, something like 40 to 50% of the people that in Asheville, the whites in Asheville voted for Barack Obama. And this difference we're attributing in part to the kind of the historical development of slavery in these two areas. The fact that Greenwood had this massive infrastructure built around slavery, and in its aftermath, kind of the Reconstruction period, you also had things like sharecropping and things like that kind of grew up in place of it. And Asheville never had that same kind of infrastructure in place, and never had the need for the kind of racialized politics that became some of the defining characteristics of places like Greenwood in the late 19th and early 20th century.
So now let me just go back, because you say both are relatively conservative. You're talking relatively conservative to the rest of the country?
To the rest of the country. Yeah, so, one thing to keep in mind is that we, you know, partially that's because we're just looking at, you know, whites in general are conservative relative to the rest of the country. You know, nationally across all races, whites are more conservative. But also just because, you know, the South, even if you look at whites, the whites in the South are a little bit more conservative than whites generally, and that's partially because there aren't a lot of big cities in the South compared to the North, where you have like large clusters of kind of urban young folks that would make the North and non-South so much more liberal than the South.
So in terms of saying that Asheville is conservative as well as Greenwood, there's a matter of degree, and Asheville is relatively conservative to, say, I don't know, Brooklyn or something like that, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. It's not, you wouldn't say that you would never say that Asheville is necessarily the same as like a place like Brooklyn or, you know, like Cambridge, Massachusetts or something like that, but it certainly relative to other cities in the South is pretty liberal.
So the primary difference in terms of the, if you look at the voting outcomes, let's say in, you know, 5 years ago, is you guys trace back to the existence of slavery as a central defining characteristic of the locale at that time? Like, what is the threshold that in your research determines whether you know, Asheville follows Asheville's path versus Greenwood follows Greenwood's path? Like, you know, where what constitutes critical mass for that difference?
Yeah, it's one thing that's kind of interesting about, at least in the time period that we're looking at, and it could change over time, but at least at the time period we're looking at, we actually see a fairly linear relationship between, you know, what proportion, you know, what was the relative number of enslaved African Americans versus whites in a county in 1860, right? And the kind of propensity to vote for the Republican Party or to hold more racially conservative views, like that relationship is fairly linear. So you get, you know, kind of as you increase the proportion enslaved in 1860, you just see an increase in the conservative voting. There doesn't seem to be, and again, this might change over time, but there doesn't seem to be a real threshold for that. That there's like these kinds of counties and those kinds of counties. I mean, we do see, you can break it out by something like, you know, kind of whether or not some place had, you know, less than 25% and greater than 25% enslaved. And you can see differences there. But what's something that's interesting about it is that it does seem to scale in this way, so that it just, you know, the denser it was in the antebellum period, the kind of the more conservative the politics are today. And we think that reflects the kind of what the incentive that people were responding to at the time about slavery, and how those things, how important it was to the area at the time, kind of scales in how many or how dense the slavery was in that period.
That's sort of amazing that it's one-to-one. Well, I don't know if it's exactly one-to-one, but it's literally that sort of that there are gradations, that you don't need a critical mass, that it really is just a function of just how conservative you get was really just how... explain to me just what you mean by proportion of enslaved people in the county. Does that mean the total number of in the population who were slaves? So if you had 90%, does that mean that like literally if there's 100 people in that county, obviously there's more, but 100 people in that county, 90 of them are slaves and 10 of them are in control?
Yeah, so there were some counties in the – that's correct. So when we're looking at – when we say proportion of slavery, yeah, we mean the total number of enslaved people in the county divided by the total number of people. And you can measure that a lot of different ways, and we've done that work. But yes, and so there are these places that, you know that for every one white person, there were nine enslaved African-Americans. And, you know, just some parts of the Mississippi Delta were just it is overwhelming to see the kind of – the way that the demographics and the, you know, the economic conditions and the kind of the terribleness of the institution is kind of overwhelming. You just, most people don't think about it in terms of how we tend to think of slavery as, oh, you know, the South had slavery, but really there was a lot of variation. Some places had basically no slaves, and some places had massive numbers where, again, it was like 9 to 1.
It was literally 9 to 1, in some areas. And so this is how you get that disparity within the context of a broader South that is pro the institution of slavery, but it's the proximity to the practice of slavery, I guess, that is the driving factor here.
Yeah, and we find one of the reasons for that we find is that it's actually not just when slavery existed, but actually when slavery went away. So after emancipation, after the Civil War, that the places that relied on slavery the most, that had the most slaves, that, you know, in fact, where the whites were outnumbered the most, kind of once the African Americans were free, these were places that their reaction to emancipation was incredibly harsh, and they tried to enact all kinds of terrible kind of Jim Crow style laws and these things called black codes to try to constrain and restrict the mobility of African Americans in that period, and all kinds of economic institutions to react to the emancipation that were directly a function of them trying to recreate the kind of economic system that they had under slavery. And so that reaction is going to scale kind of with how dependent you are as a local area on slavery.
Wow. Okay. So the reaction is what creates the sort of the biggest institutions. Are there examples of, and I want to talk about how that translates into, you know, sort of, I guess, attitudes. But as you say that if you have the highest concentration of slaves to non-slaves, to presumably their, you know, their owners or those who are sort of like enabling their owners. And that you can see that in voting patterns 240 years later, I mean, almost, right? Or 200 years later, or I guess maybe closer to 180, but how does that match up in terms of figures? Is that because you had a lot of former slaves leave the area? Or, I mean, how does that translate? Or are you looking at the granular numbers, not the results from the county, but how the white population voted?
Yeah, so that's the key thing here, which is actually kind of is interesting to look at, because if you look at a map of how the South votes and superpose it on one of these maps of the density of slavery, what you'll see from it is it looks like that the former black belt, the cotton belt that kind of goes down through the southern states, the deep south, if you look at that area now on you know, kind of the red blue typical maps you see on TV and things, that's actually pretty deep blue. And the reason for that is these former slave areas also happen to be places where they're not happen to be, but as a direct consequence of this, are places where there are relatively dense populations of African Americans today. And so you do see that if you just look at the kind of the vote, it looks like those areas are more liberal, and they are because there are large proportions of African Americans. But what we wanted to do was actually tease this out for whites, because we thought, you know, that those are the people for which we think that this kind of mechanism, this kind of path, the behavioral path dependence could really act. And so, yeah, so a lot of what we do in the paper and in the book is trying to figure out, you know, how can we find this out for white folks in the South? And, you know, we do that in a couple of different ways. One is to get relatively recent big surveys that ask a lot of questions of a lot of people so that we can get huge over samples of Southern whites to kind of really get a sense for the geographic dispersion of their attitudes. And we also use election outcome data, election kind of vote data, and combine it with some data from the voter file in terms of turnout by race, which you can get in the South, or you could get in the South when the Voting Rights Act was still working. And you can use that information to kind of back out what you think the white vote is in these areas. And so that's kind of helped us. So we're really focusing on white folks. And so the kind of idea is that some of these families that have passed down these things over time are because throughout the generations, at least among white people in the South.
So if I understand you correctly, it's possible, and it's actually fairly consistent that you have some of these areas that are the bluest areas, you know, on a county level in the South, have some of the most racist white voters. Is that? Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah. I would say that's a fair characterization of what we're saying, and I think it's partly instructive to kind of think about. You know, one thing that's always kind of helped me is when, you know, you think about places like, you know, we think of West Virginia, and West Virginia is kind of like, you know, border South, left Virginia because of the Civil War and things like that, but is a useful comparison sometimes. Think about it, in the minds of most Americans, we think of West Virginia as being so solidly red that, you know, just deep, deep red, very Republican. And we kind of compare that to a place like, to Georgia or Mississippi or Alabama, which we do also think of as being pretty red, but with kind of blue streaks, literal blue streaks. But also, you know, there are Democratic representatives from those states, and I think we tend to think I don't know if we equate them, but I think what we don't realize is actually, if you were to just take all the white people in Mississippi and Alabama and compare them to the white people in West Virginia, I think what you'd find is that they're actually a lot more liberal they're more liberal in West Virginia than they are in Alabama and Mississippi. And you can actually, going back in history, you can see that where West Virginia was an area that actually had, when there was the solid South of Democrats, you know, West Virginia actually elected Republican governors, more liberal Republican governors. And so it's an interesting, you know, I think sometimes these kind of old populations of people tend to mask the kind of underlying individual level variation in attitudes that is pretty interesting. And I think especially that's true about the way that race masks kind of white, you know, the differences among races can mask some of the white conservatism in the South.
So wait a second. So that is, the individual white voters in West Virginia are less racist than those pockets of white voters in those other states you mentioned. So why does that translate? So is in that instance in West Virginia, is it that their conservative views are not a function of race? Is that I'm hung
I
up
just,
on that.
Yeah, so part of it is that I think we just don't see it because, you know, we never get an election where just everyone and all only the white, you know, not anymore. We don't get elections where everyone, you know, only the white people vote in Mississippi or Alabama. You know, whereas that is basically, you know, given the demographics of West Virginia, that's what every election is in West Virginia. And so I think if you were to hold an election where you only white people could vote, right, and we gave them, you know, we would see that that West Virginia, I think, would generally tend to be slightly more liberal on a lot of set of issues than like the white folks in Alabama.
Slightly more liberal or less conservative?
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly. So, I mean, this is all like relative degrees. And
okay.
So it's not like we're not talking about it's, you know, it's not going to be, you know, obviously West Virginia is not like, you know, Massachusetts or something like that, or even New Hampshire, but it's going to be relatively less conservative than these other areas. And I think, you know, to some extent, you kind of see that in some of the politics coming out of places like West Virginia. It's tend to be, you know, they do tend to, there's, I think, more kind of toying with or entertaining liberal ideas when it comes to, say, unions and things like that than we really see in the Deep South.
But West Virginia, now, has West Virginia become more conservative over time? I'm getting confused with sort of just like partisan realignment, is a question. And B, if it is the case, does this mean that race is not exclusively the most predominant factor in determining how conservative, broadly speaking, a population would be?
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction, and it kind of helps with the West Virginia case too. Because one thing we do find is we found in our previous research is the following, which is that if you look at areas of the South that had legalized, you know, had allowed slavery, it was legal, but had very little slavery itself. You know, these are kind of places along the northern border states, places like West Virginia, and you match them up with similarly rural areas just on the other side of the border, and then in the kind of quote unquote north, so places in southern Ohio, Indiana, places like that. What you find is actually very little difference in the attitudes that we see between those two areas, right? And that suggests that there is some. You know, that can mean a couple of different things. I mean, certainly it's the case that, you know, at least we can't, you know, 100% of the variation in conservative attitude is obviously not due to something like slavery. And that could be for a number of reasons. It could be because there is like a significant other part of conservatism that is just part of the belief structure that drives people to be conservative or other kind of life experiences. It could also be that their geographic mobility in the country has made this trying to tease these two things out very difficult, right? A lot of black and white people moved out of the South in the, you know, first half of the 20th century during the Great Migration to places in the North and places in the West. So we did have big exoduses of both black and white folks that could kind of, in some sense, if you think about those kind of, those are now spilling over into other areas. And so it becomes harder over time to kind of see these relationships. They tend to attenuate over time just because you have people moving like that. And so it's hard to tease those two things apart. It could still be the case that a lot of this is being driven by race. It's just kind of indirectly through people moving, but we can't quite tease it out without getting a full accounting of everyone's family history. And that's obviously very difficult.
Right. So the idea is that, getting back to the Reconstruction era, when you had a county that had a high proportion of slavery or slaves, essentially to white folk, the responses were basically to subjugate black people who are now free economically, politically. This goes on through the Jim Crow era. And so the idea is that theoretically the lessons that are learned, I mean, as, you know, hey, Pa, why is it there's a poll tax? Well, I'll tell you, son, like these ideas are then communicated and embedded in this next generation. And they retain these ideas, essentially, right, and even if they move to West Virginia, they still have these ideas, even if those measures aren't there, or they implement those measures there for reasons maybe that they have forgotten or were never firsthand experienced as to why they were doing this.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one thing that is always, for, I mean, for us, it's somewhat humbling about doing research like this, is that I think it makes you question a little bit the degree to which you've come to your own beliefs as like a true rational person, where you sat down and really thought about all the alternatives and decided that, you know, my political beliefs are directly a function of that rationality. I think that's how all of us like to perceive ourselves. But really, when it comes down to it, a lot of it is being shaped by our family history and our upbringing in various ways. And I think definitely in the South, you saw there are some really kind of amazing descriptions of this in what is now called kind of a racial etiquette, in the way that children were raised in a way to kind of follow rules of interacting with members of the opposite race. In the South, it was highly codified, you know, informally. It wasn't always legal, but there would be strict rules about, say, when a young white child was walking on a sidewalk and a black adult approached them, who would get out of the way, right? And who had the right of way in that situation? It was always the young white child, and there were certain ways that young white children were allowed to talk to adult African Americans. And these kinds of structures were heavily enforced, right? Along with things like, you know, children's versions of things like the KKK, you know, clubs that kids would join as part of this, and all of these kinds of these infrastructure was built up around making sure that, you know, that white and black people understood what the rules were for interacting, and in particular to make sure that everyone understood that African Americans were in a subjugated position relative to whites. Right. And I think that it was overwhelming when you look at kind of the people that have done historical work to figure this out. And it's hard to imagine that, you know, a situation like that doesn't color how you view the world moving forward and how maybe you talk about race to your children moving forward. So even if some of those, that codification ended in the 19, you know, or became less prominent in the middle part of the 20th century, it could still be the case that, you know, a lot of the people that grew up learning those lessons might still be alive. They might still be voting. So it's. I think that's an important consideration, and one that we think is really important for the results that we find in the book.
And the intensity of the racism is tied directly into the proportion in which that community relied on slave labor, because their reaction, almost like the blowback from emancipation, had to be that much more severe and strong. And so they're constructing sort of more racist social mores because from their perspective, the threat of loss of power was that much greater.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about situations where the local white in a county, the local white population, again, might be outnumbered 9-1. So if you just think about, you know, majority vote, that's a problem for a white population that really saw itself as being the only like responsible group of people to be able to run society. And the idea was that they're, if you read kind of historical accounts and first person historical newspaper accounts of the white reaction to emancipation, it was very dramatic. I mean, they were obsessed with the kind of labor problems that were going to come down the road for them. They were obsessed with the political issues that were going to come down the road. And so, these were highly localized, right? And so that's why we see this kind of local effect.
How do you measure the intensity of racism, relative to, let's say, an area? And we should say the area follows the Black Belt, which is literally a description of very fertile soil that allowed for the growing of cotton and maybe other commodities that would require a higher rate of slavery within, you know, that area. So it's sort of I guess, you know, we see this in the context of other, you know, if you're in thousands of years ago living in a fertile area, agriculture becomes your primary, you know, the agriculture becomes the primary driver, and society is constructed around that. That notion exists, and so it makes that sense. But how do you measure through time the the relative levels of racism from a county that, say, had 9-to-1 ratio versus, let's say, 5-to-5 or, 7-to-3.
Yeah, it's. I mean, so that's. I think for us, that was the most, one of the most challenging things about the book, and one of the reasons why we decided to write a book was because we thought, part of it is kind of data, data detective work, trying to find the little bits of quantitative evidence that we could get from whatever source. So it looks like different things in different time periods. So, when we had to look about a little bit about this in the antebellum period, and there we were looking at how different members of the Georgia state legislature voted, and how did the ones that lived in the kind of high slave areas vote compared to the low slave areas. We looked at how, in kind of moving forward to more of the Jim Crow area, we were looking at how did counties, when ratification of Jim Crow state constitutions, in particular we looked at Alabama, were up for a vote to ratify the constitution that was explicitly about restricting the kind of ability of disenfranchising African Americans, putting all the kind of Jim Crow era laws on them. And we looked at, how did the counties vote for this, and we find that, the areas that have higher levels of slavery were more likely to vote for to ratify the constitutional amendment that would disenfranchise African Americans. Later on, we got data on lynchings over the course of the kind of late 19th, early 20th century, and found that as a proportion of the total number of people, there were more lynchings of African Americans in these areas relative to the low slave areas. And then moving kind of steadily moving forward in time, we can use once the disenfranchisement of African Americans is complete, we can actually use just the vote shares in these areas because those are just basically white elections. And so we can look at how they voted in terms of national elections in that time period. And then fast forwarding, over time to today, we can start to look at things like big surveys that are being done by the National Election Survey, done by political scientists in Michigan, and then the another survey that's now kind of even bigger. And we can look at questions that specifically ask people things like, how warmly do you feel about this group, on a scale from 0 to 100? And ask about, what do you think about black people? What do you think about white people? And we can look at just the difference between those two numbers as a measure of kind of racial preference.
Wow.
And then today, now there's political science is trying to get very sophisticated about how it measures kind of views on race that don't necessarily, that are kind of more, say, hidden than the kind of obvious racism of the biological racism of the past. And so we use some of those kind of more subtle measures in the current time period. In the surveys in the last few years. But I mean, it's just, for us, it was all about, where could we get the different data sources to piece it together to kind of, to try to trace this out over time, because there's no one data source.
No one was taking the poll for the past 200 years. What are your attitudes towards,
right? It would be great if the census should have asked us, but they did not. So we had to rely on just kind of finding things as we went.
Okay, so I have two sort of, I guess, major questions to ask you left. One is the persistence. So, I mean, you've talked about, you can, and you said earlier, you could see that this is linear. Like, you can follow the trajectory of this. And I imagine, when you say that you can measure the incidence of lynchings, and I would presume probably to the extent that data is available, in the 20s, it may have been a little bit more public or at least, newspaper reports, like the incidence or the size of the Klan in a specific area. I would imagine that in and of itself provides the durability, like each era provides its own sort of reproduction machine of these attitudes. Is that the case? And B, if it is the case, are there areas where that falls off? Like is there nothing that can then break that other than sort of distance, generational distance from that slavery?
Yeah. So, I mean, we try to take this up a little bit. It's a tough question. Like what is the, someone asked us once very early on when we were writing this, like, what's the half-life, the kind of radioactive half-life of this? Like, when should we expect this to kind of go away? And so we try to look at that a little bit, and it's a difficult question just because it's hard to compare some of these measures over time. But one thing we do see is that when we look at things that are outcome measures where we see that the federal government has really gotten involved and taken action, where things like voting rights, things like kind of educational inequalities, things like even income inequalities, what we see is that those types of measures, the kind of black-white wage gap, the black-white education gap, and the black-white kind of turnout gap, those things used to be really heavily correlated with slavery back in the early part of the 20th century, right? So it's kind of the same story we've been telling about these things, that you saw this both in terms of attitudes, but also in terms of the kind of inequalities between whites and blacks. Now, even though those inequalities still exist between blacks and whites, but they're actually much, much less correlated with slavery than they were in the 1940s. Right. And so that speaks to the fact that part of what happened was that the federal government actually went in and had some really big interventions, things like the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act in the 1960s, actually had a big impact on kind of flattening the relation, the kind of how local some of these effects are on some of these outcomes. Right. And so that's, we see that as like an interesting, I don't know if a success, but an interesting kind of way that when the federal government actually got involved and did something, it actually had a pretty big impact. What we don't see that on is things like these attitudes. The relationships that we see between slavery and attitudes in the middle part of the 20th century are not that different than the relationship between attitudes and slavery that we see in the early part of the 21st century. And to some extent, that we think that kind of speaks to this idea that it's hard to change the kind of hearts and minds, and we don't really know what that's going to look like moving forward. And so, we'd like, you know, it could be the case that these things just kind of march and get kind of, they dissipate slowly and slowly and slowly. But on the other hand, it could be the case that kind of entrepreneurial politicians are able to kind of latch on to some of these political divisions and actually kind of reactivate them in some ways. And I think it's hard to know how that lasts. I mean, to give you a sense of how long.
That's sort of terrifying in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, to give you an example of this,
I understand you, just to restate, federal intervention is a fairly effective means in which to make some material differences, and presumably in the worst case scenarios, right? Because that's where you're most likely a fair. But despite these material differences, attitudes have a persistence that is incredible, it seems like, and that persistence and that durability is also a function of people out there who know that it's latent and at any time can sort of re-up its virulence.
I think that's totally correct, and I think one, you know, outside of the context of the South, one thing, you know, we one piece of literature, a paper in economics that showed that they related voting for the Nazi Party in Germany in the 20th century was related to the Black Death era pogroms and anti-Semitism, like, you know, in the 12th century. Right, hundreds of years of persistence. And again, that kind of shows you, I think what's interesting about that example is not only is it like not, we don't necessarily have this thing where just everything goes away, but it could be that there are, you know, again, kind of entrepreneurial politicians that can take advantage of these kinds of divisions and reignite them. And I think that's something that, you know, we tend to think of everything as progress is marching forward and things like that. But I do think that it doesn't, you know, there are ways that it could go in different directions. And I think that's something to watch out for as time marches on.
Okay. My last question for you is, largely outside of your portfolio, I think, but seems to me to be highly implicated in your research. What about the converse? Like, what about those areas where you had a 9-to-1 slave to, you know, a slave owner, more or less? What were the implications if the attitudes that were so ingrained, that are so, were developed then in response to emancipation and presumably slavery, right? I mean, to justify it, these are they're two sides of the same coin. Are so durable in white people. What about the attitudes that would have necessarily come with being subjugated in black people?
Yeah, you know, we've looked at this a little bit, but I mean, one issue that we've kind of faced with studying kind of African American views on this and kind of how that we think there's obviously a huge legacy of slavery for African Americans. I think, but the thing that makes it difficult to study for us is that, you know, for white folks, they could vote.
They did things in society which would indicate their attitudes. And black people, largely during that period, have no ability to articulate that in the public record.
Right. Well, not just that, but there's a variety of ways that whites could interact with society, and variety of ways that they could interact with the slavery and the issues of post emancipation. Whereas African Americans had basically uniformly treated by these institutions, right? Basically, you know, massive proportions were enslaved. You know, so it's not like there was a big group of African Americans that were not enslaved that we could look at. How did their attitudes form over time if they didn't interact with slavery? Whereas with white folks, we definitely have these areas where they just didn't interact with slavery all that much. And so there's more. We think that the impact on African Americans was so overwhelming that it makes it actually difficult to kind of study, because it's hard to figure out, well, what would have it looked like for them if this institution didn't exist. I mean, that's almost like a crazy question to even wrap your head around. And I think that's what makes it a difficult thing to study. Having said that, I think, you know, there is evidence that African Americans have higher degrees of what's called linked fate, where they tend to think about what's good for the group is good for me, in terms of the descriptive representation and things like that. And we think that could be in part driven by this kind of interaction, the way of being subjugated in this way, in this manner, definitely seems like something that could lead to those kinds of attitudes over a long period of time.
At the very least, your research shows that the legacy of slavery, particularly how it impacts attitudes, individual attitudes, has an incredible amount of durability.
Yeah. We were surprised, and we kind of threw the kitchen sink at it, and it's still there. And so it's definitely something that we were surprised by to some extent. I mean, it's hard. Sometimes we feel surprised by it, and sometimes we feel like it's just completely obvious. So it's just hard to balance those two ideas. It's such an important institution, but it's 250 years, you know, it's just hard to wrap your head around that.
Matthew Blackwell, the book is Deep Roots, How Slavery Still Shapes Southern Politics, and I guess if you had room, American politics. We will put a link to that at majorityreportradio.com. Thanks so much for your time today. Really fascinating.
All right. Thank you so much for this.
Let's...
we get into dessert now?
Yes. We're going to start with dessert. Now, Matt got into a little exchange with a man on Twitter, or a woman. I don't know. We don't know. You know, Twitter is semi-anonymous always, I guess. I don't know. And replying to Matt, this individual on Twitter said, Sam Cedar challenged Steven Crowder fans to find the truth, but you fail to validate your claims for irrational political vengeance? I'm not sure I get what. What?
What was the first part of this?
This is just us wanting him, demanding a debate.
I see.
Yeah.
If you have some sort of evidence, then put it on the table. Otherwise, what can be asserted without evidence can be dismissed without evidence. Fair enough. This was in November of 2018. And I waited. Part of the reason why I waited, because I had a feeling I'd get another piece. And that happened back in May. And I've waited because I was also hoping for another opportunity, but it's not coming. So what do we start with? Should we do this chronologically, or do we go reverse chronology?
Maybe reverse chronology.
Yes, I think we'll save the more media friendly for a second. So back in May, early May, I got an email. Oh, no, this must have been the first one must have come actually, I think, in April, from a guy named Jim. And he wrote, Hello, Sam Cedar team. My name is Jim, and I work for freespeech.tv. This is a new network being launched on June 1st. We're wondering if Sam would accept our invite to be on the show. The show is a panel discussion that will have a conservative and a liberal on every show to discuss current events and politics for about an hour. The show is called Free Speech and will be hosted by Gavin McGinnis. We can pay Sam's for Sam's travel and stay, plus pay him $5,000 to be on the show.
You should have gotten a hotel in Midtown, bro.
We have a lot of big names on both sides of the aisle, I-S-L-E, that have agreed to be on. We're hoping Sam can too. T-O. We will be filming 2 episodes a month for 12 months so we can work around Sam's schedule, Jim. Now, I have to say, when I get an email like this, I am suspicious. Because, one, Gavin McGinnis wants me on his TV show. Okay. He's going to pay me $5,000. I don't get $5,000 for anything. I don't know if all the appearances I've made on MSNBC over the past year, I will get $5,000 in the aggregate for. Probably not, actually. So I got very suspicious on this. Now, whenever I get suspicious, what I do is I send it off. I say, I'm not going to answer this. I'm going to have Patrick answer it. Patrick, who works, you never hear me reference him because he works in the basement here at the jury report. We just bring him out to just look at it. So Patrick responds and says, oh, yeah, Sam's, you know, could be interested. Tell us more. Jim writes back, what nights, and this is May 21st, what nights in June? Oh, okay, so we talk and this and that, and at one point he says, oh, yeah, here he goes. Okay, so, hello, Patrick. Thank you for getting back to us. The show is being filmed in a professional studio downtown Manhattan. There will be makeup, because Patrick was very concerned that I needed makeup.
Patrick throws a lot of shade at you.
Yeah, Patrick is... No, but Patrick was like, well, Sam wants to know if there's going to be makeup. I mean, I was just curious, like, what the heck is going on here? And so there will be makeup. About 30 guests in the audience. The show will be shown on Free Speech TV, but we'll be putting up some interesting parts of the show on YouTube. The show is all about having conservative and liberal ideals being represented in long-form, hour-long discussion. I saw Sam's interview with Glenn Greenwald the other day. That was awesome. This is kind of the same idea. The guests maybe not agree on some of the current political topics discussed, but we do it in a fun and respectable manner where both perspectives are shared on any given topic.
Is this person ESL? Like, they keep using the wrong word for things.
Well, I don't know, but I have a feeling that Jim is not really Jim.
Maybe you guys should lay off Jim.
I think Jim used to work at Vice.
I think Jim has a drinking problem.
Now... We want the viewers from right to left to be able to do both sides, not feel like they're watching another Fox News or MSNBC echo chamber. Gavin would be the host of the show, and the two guests will be a liberal and conservative on each show. We're shooting 2 episodes a month for a year so we can work around Sam's schedule. Is there a particular conservative guest Sam would like to be on the panel with? We could make it work. Steven Crowder might be a good pairing, for instance. And he is willing to do the show.
Ooh.
I have noticed a lot of Sam's fans want Sam to debate Steven. This could be perfect forum for that. We're getting a great response. Blah, 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 blah. The psychos. Blah, 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 blah. We could do a conference call with Gavin if you guys wanted to. Now, here's where I think, like, oh, this is real. And I'm not going to go do a show where Gavin gets to pretend he's Dick Cavett. I'm not going to go do a show where Gavin pretends that he is like some type of just neutral host, because Gavin is clearly trying to resuscitate his career. Now, I would go on with Gavin on his show if it was live, where I could record my version of it. And I would have Gavin on my show if we were going to debate about something, and I would do it for free. The only way that I would agree to help revive Gavin's career is for a minimum of $250,000. But I would pay my way. I would get there on my own, and you wouldn't have to put me up.
That's not the point. So then Jim writes, don't go to this yet. On May 21st, what nights in June will work for Sam? We ideally are going to shoot in the city around 8 p.m. Friday. It's the lousy studio, blah, blah, blah. Thank you greatly, Jim. Patrick responds, hi, Jim. Sam says, whatever night Crowder is there works for him. P, Patrick. And Jim responds on May 21st at 3:21 p.m. Awesome. Thank you. We'll be back soon with dates. Then on May 30th, we haven't heard anything. And I say to Patrick, Patrick, what's the deal? And he writes on May 30th, hey, Jim, Sam just asked, what's up? Do we have a date yet? And then on May 30th, 11:32 a.m., thanks for following up. I'm sorry it's taken so long. I'm working hard on it, and we are in dialogue over it with Crowder. I will know more in coming days. I will get back to you for sure. Thanks again. I think it'll be awesome when it happens. I think Sam is hilarious.
Thanks, Jim. Patrick, you tell Jim that I said thank you.
But then June 3rd comes around. And Patrick, I almost said me. Hey, and Patrick writes, hey, Jim, any word? Question mark. And Jim writes back on June 3rd. Yep. Made some progress over the weekend. Hope to have an answer for you guys at the end of the week. Thanks so much. I just want this as just as bad as you slash Sam want it. And then on June 9th, Jim writes, we tried hard, man, but he just won't do it with Sam. Very disappointing. Is there anyone else that Sam might want to be on the show with? Just a couple ideas. Ann Coulter lined up on the 26th. We could offer
boring.
Sam. Also, what about Jimmy Dore? We've been talking to him. Thank you, Jim.
Oh, my God. Where is the Trump cuck?
And so Patrick writes back, oof, I'll ask him about the others. What happened with Crowder? He won't do your show or won't do it with Sam? Did he give a reason why? Sam's going to be cranky with me, which is true. I was really cranky when Patrick told me this. And then Patrick, I didn't get a response. And I was like, Patrick, what's the deal? And so he writes to Jim on June 12th. Hey, Jim, so now Sam thinks I messed up somehow on the Crowder thing. And that's why it's not happening. He didn't really react when I mentioned any of the other names. I can press him again, though. I'm sorry, Patrick. I was so cranky and wanted
Klobuchar-esque.
Well, I thought that I said to Patrick, I said, hey, man, did you screw this up? Because I wanted to debate Crowder. And he's like, no, I didn't. And I said, are you sure? And he's like, no. And so that's why he wrote Jim that way.
Then you threw a chair at him.
And then Jim wrote back. All right, man. I know you guys are going to be pissed, but here it is what we got out of Crowder. Crowder said he has 4 million YouTube followers and Sam has 500K followers. We already up to now 650,000.
Growing fast, faster than Crowder.
Wow.
And he didn't want Sam trying to ride in on his coattails of hard work, blood, sweat, and death threats just to lend his notoriety to Sam, which would help Sam gain some of his followers. And Crowder hates Sam for some reason, so he doesn't want to help Sam.
I believe that part.
I do too. Now, the funny part is, now, of course, like...
Wait a second. Crowder's willing to lend his brand out to unknown college kids.
Well,
imagine
that's the point.
Imagine what they capitalize on.
I happen to know for a fact that there's never been a single college kid that Steven Crowder has debated that has even close to 4 million YouTube followers. In fact, I will bet that I have more YouTube followers than any college student that he has ever debated. And I would also argue that he probably, anybody that he was going to go on with on Gavin's show, and I don't know, has he appeared on Gavin's show? Why don't we look that up? Don't have much more followers than I do. Maybe by, I don't know, 10%, 30%, you know, 20%, but not 400%. Anyways, Crowder was supposed to be on our show last week, so this had nothing to do with Gavin. It's just Sam unpopularity with Steven. So it appears the Crowder wouldn't even go and show up on the show. What's that? He was on what?
Whoa, this is interesting. I don't know, the causation correlation
Gavin tried so hard multiple times. He tried so hard that now Crowder is mad at Gavin for pushing so hard for it to happen. I thought if anyone could make this happen, it was Gavin. But he could not convince him after multiple attempts to do it. We were fucking pissed. We think it's stupid for him not to do it and that it would go viral. I think with Crowder getting demonetized did not help things either. I'm not going to give up, but I figured for now it's not going anywhere. I would not be surprised in the near future if we get him to rethink it. We told him he is just as bad of the 19 out of 20 liberals that say no to Gavin when we ask them to be on.
Oof.
Hard to have a dialogue when no one wants to fucking talk to each other.
So hard.
Yeah.
It's hard to have a fucking dialogue.
With that said, we would still like to have Sam on with someone. Maybe if Steven sees that episode of Sam with some other conservative, then maybe he could open up the dialogue for a future date. We have Candace Owens on September 6th and blah, blah, blah. We could, on the conservative side, we could use some help of getting here. Liberals, if you have any idea, the show is about having both sides and et cetera, et cetera. I'm sorry it didn't happen. We're going to try and get Sam and Steven. I personally love Sam and watch his show every day. It's a very thing, sweet thing to say, Jim. Weird that you would need to put me up when you know that the show is done every day from Brooklyn and this show tapes in New York, but maybe it's true. I'm glad he does. No hard feelings, Jim. And then I just wrote back, Patrick wrote back, because I want to see, I asked Patrick, how much money are they willing to pay before we say, before we go public with this? And then it turned out just $5,000 was about as far as they were going to go. So then we were like, okay, now it's time to go public.
It's definitely a new movie. Sam and Gavin, anonymous pen pals.
So now look.
They hated each other in public.
One time each other is not private. Evidence of anything, in some of you will say. That just happened once. But no, ladies and gentlemen, this was a pattern. This happened in the spring of 2019, but back in the summer, early fall of 2018, there was an event that I was thinking about attending, but it was contingent upon me being able to have a debate with someone who I thought was influencing the younger generation on YouTube. I mean, that was basically my idea. And if it's someone who I think is doing that, I don't care how many. Well, the fact that he has, you know, with 3 or 4 million YouTube views or subscribers is indicative of how many people he's reaching and why I think that's problematic. Roger Stone, I don't know how many YouTube subscribers he has. He's a fairly big name, but I don't think many, frankly, young people follow Roger Stone or care what he says. And so he's less relevant to me. So here is a recording that was made that captures a phone call that took place between myself and a booker recorded in New York, which is a one-party state. We have altered the voices just slightly, and no names are involved here. I mean, of the other party. I don't normally do this, to be honest with you, in terms of recording calls like this, but there was radio silence. I was supposed to debate Steven Crowder, and I was very, very much looking forward to it. Do you remember, Brendan? I was supposed to debate him at an event that took place in California, and this year it's taking place at a different place in the country. I think it's Tennessee. And I was very excited about this. But then all of a sudden, I didn't hear anything. And so when the person said, can we get on the phone? I was like, okay, but that's weird. And I'm in a one-party state. So Because I had anticipated that something was going to go sideways. And here is that exchange.
Things are moving along. I was literally just building your proposed schedule panel.
Oh, great.
I know. It's very exciting stuff. So you'll have all of that soon. I did want to talk to you about the debate.
Okay.
So it seems that Steven Crowder has maybe gotten some cold feet.
Okay.
And feeling a little intimidated, so I don't think he's coming.
He's not even going to come?
Right.
Why is that? Pause it. Now, I want people to understand that this is just this lady's, you know, assessment. She's not inside Steven Crowder's head. The fact that he got cold feet because he felt a little intimidated, that's just her assessment. I want to be fair here. It's just her assessment. Go ahead.
You know, it's a great question. I would love to ask it to him myself. He's not even answering anymore.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay. That's too bad.
Interesting. But I have two other options for you that I think might be interesting.
Okay.
And if they're not, we can go to the drawing board. We're happy to do that. So we have Candace Owens coming from Turning Point USA. Are you familiar with her? Kanye's a big fan.
Sure.
The other one we have, which actually I think would be my preference, I think it could be very interesting, and I think it's a very interesting dynamic, is Dan Bongino.
Who is Dan Bongino?
Dan Bongino, you know, he eluded me at the beginning because I didn't quite understand who he was. He's had insane growth on YouTube and Facebook Live and things of that nature. He was former Secret Service. And now it's just a big pro-Trumper. I'd love to send you some info and background on him and kind of what our idea is behind it.
Okay.
But if neither option is favorable, I can absolutely go back to the drawing board. I have not a single problem doing that. I want to make sure this is a great experience, number one, for you, and something that's interesting and toothsome for you to get into also.
Yeah. I mean, I'm familiar with Candace Owens, and that might work. But send me information about that other guy. I just have never heard of him. That's a real shame.
I think you're bigger. Yeah, I don't know what his team is doing around him, and that's, you know, just for me to speculate at this point.
Pause it. Want to make sure that we understand this is speculation. I imagine it's informed speculation. Also, let me just say, I didn't mean any offense to Dan Bongino. I just had never heard of who he was. I didn't know who he was. And but let's hear the speculation. It's speculation, folks. Just go back just a little bit, because as you can see, I was really interested in getting more information about Steven Crowder. It work, but send me information about that other guy. I just have never heard of him. That's a real shame.
I think you're bigger. Yeah, I don't know what his team is doing around him, and that's, you know, just for me to speculate at this point. I don't know.
He has a team. He has a whole team, and he won't do it. He can bring the team.
I believe it's his father, but I can't confirm or deny that.
Okay. All right.
I'm not sure. That was just my inference.
Pause it. I want to make it clear. She says here, this is just her inference, so she doesn't know. She doesn't know. I mean, it would be a weird thing to just sort of randomly say, I think it's his parent. His mom didn't want him to, or his dad didn't want him to.
Just out of nowhere to come up with that.
But that's the inference. And then we pull it back just 10, 15 seconds. Then, I mean, you have to put yourself in my mind, like, this is the first I ever heard of that. And I'm like, wait a second. Crowder's not a teenager, right? Like, does his folks know he's doing this? That's a real shame.
I think you're bigger. Yeah, I don't know what his team is doing around him, and that's, you know, just for me to speculate at this point. I don't know.
He has a team? He has a whole team, and he won't do it? He can bring the team.
I believe it's his father, but I can't confirm or deny that.
Okay. All right.
I'm not quite sure. That was just my inference.
I understand. Well, I mean, he's young, isn't he? He's not that young, is he?
He's a young guy. He's in his 20s.
Oh, okay. all right. Well, send me that. What about Dave Rubin? Is he?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I went on to Dave Rubin to see if I can get Rubin.
Steven Crowder is literally 3 8-year-old boys in a trench coat. This phone call proves it.
Well, that's why you got to have dad now. Now, look, I understand. Steven is. Steven doesn't have the confidence necessarily to back up his, change my mind. But let me put it this way. Steven Crowder is not capable of defending his positions with an adult who has spent a little time reading up about these things and is somewhat knowledgeable about this stuff. Oh, he's 32 years old. Wow. All right. Well, to be fair,
maybe 31.
At the time when this conversation happened, he was probably 31. And I know that, my daddy made sure that I wasn't going to get into a situation where I would feel embarrassed well into my late 30s. So, but at one point.
Will he be with Sarah Jessica Parker in this scene?
Exactly. At one point, Steven Crowder has got to man up and actually have a debate with people who are aware that they're going to have a debate, that aren't going to, in between psych classes or, run into a booth and then go sit down with him. I'd be like me going to, an elementary school and saying, like, who's going to play one-on-one basketball with me right now? Just did this because I know a lot of Crowder fans out there feel... No, wait a second. I don't want to laugh about this because this is not easy for folks. There's a lot of people out there who think that Steven Crowder is some kind of champion of theirs. And the fact is that if he actually felt confident about what he espouses, he would be open to having a real exchange with people who know what they're talking about. Which is not to say that college students don't, but like I say, I've seen some kids who do quite well with Crowder, but I mean, to be walking down the quad and just seeing a booth, you're not prepared for it. You don't know who you're dealing with. You don't know what the topic is.
And sometimes they do pretty well anyway.
It's true. It's true. And look, Crowder is largely, most of the things I've seen, trying to argue the, really, in many respects, the indefensible. And he does well with some of these students. Not so well with others. And we're only looking at the video that he wants to release, too. So,
well, if he wants someone more age appropriate to debate him, the rest of the MR crew is available.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm going to have to check with my mom.
But, Steven, you can come on this program. You can record it. We'll do it live. I am willing to go on your program, do it live. We can do it in another venue if you want. But you can hide behind the fact that you have more YouTube subscribers than I do, but it really sort of breaks down when you're willing to debate college students who don't even have YouTube channels. If you want, when we have this debate, I will not monetize it. I will not put ads on that day. I will demonetize it on YouTube. You don't want me to gain any of that? If you're worried about losing your followers or your supporters, that is fair. Because if I was you, I would be worried about that. In fact, that's the whole point of this. The whole point of this is to say to people who think that Steven Crowder knows what he's talking about, begin to understand that if he really knew what he was talking about, he wouldn't be afraid to defend it. So that's why we're doing this. And if you are a fan of Steven Crowder's, you should reach out to him and say, hey, man, there's two examples of you ducking Sam Cedar in an embarrassing way. And look, how many times the two examples you get documentary and audio evidence of something like that? Right? Never. This is somebody who's super, super nervous about it.
Fragile.
So, super fragile.
Yeah, hopefully the algorithm will get it in front of some of those people's eyeballs.
Yeah, we'll see. But folks, feel free to go into any of Steven Crowder's chat rooms. Put up a link.
Hashtag Cold Feet Crowder.
Cold feet.
A lot of people are saying it's Cold Feet Crowder.
I thought it was disgraceful. And the fact that his friend Gavin worked so hard for him pretending to be Jim and he left him out in the cold like that. I mean, I just thought it was very cowardly and very sad. Maybe he should ask his father.
You know, there
maybe
is,
his father should debate this.
There case. Is a theory about people who lift that many weights. That in some ways that they are trying to, like, literally, you know, wrap themselves, like, protect themselves from something that they're really worried about inside. And I suspect that maybe there's something inside of Steven that he is having a tough time with. And it can come out in a lot of different weird ways.
Lots of things.
So
many
maybe
things.
Try lifting some books next time.
Well, I think until Steven can look at himself in the mirror and feel proud about all the things about him, not have to worry about maybe Dad not accepting things about Steven, like his limitations or his perspective on things. I don't know. I'm sure there's a sadness there. Let's go to this. This is exciting. Let's just get this out of the way, shall we? Yeah. Folks, as you know, Steven Crowder, we dropped the Crowder files the other day. And we, again, encourage you to take a picture of your socks and help Steven Crowder, who got cold feet, and just send it to him as an inspiration for him to get some, maybe to warm his feet up and come and talk to us. I just want to say, I want to thank all of you who have participated in this. And I don't want to single out anybody who has been, you know, getting on Steven Crowder to debate me. But this guy, obviously, I've been a huge fan of his work in the film world. And so I was really appreciated him weighing in. Folks, I give you Kevin Sorbo.
Well, Steven. You got cold feet, I understand. Cold feet, and you won't debate Sam. Why will you not debate Sam? But just to let you know, Sam is still up for it. All right? So just call Sam, and you'll set something up. But if Steven's dad won't let him debate you for some reason... Sam understands. He says he gets it. All right.
You should rewind that.
I hope I've done my job. And I'd be remiss if I didn't promote my latest movie streaming on Amazon.
Wait, can we rewind to the part where he's where this part about the dad? That's incredible.
Yeah, that was.
That's some very fine writing right in the middle.
Now, we got to say hat tip to listener Ryan, who I think paid for this. I don't know how much he paid for it. It could have been like $90. We could get that guy a t-shirt.
It was at Ryan Rec, R-E-C-6-6.
Yeah,
there I was thinking Kevin Sorbo was a fan of ours.
No, sorry. It turns out that Kevin Sorbo
Am I doing something wrong with the...
Are you not plugged in there?
I'm plugged in with my headphones.
Oh, you got to plug that into the cord.
Oh, where does this go?
There you go. Sorry.
Well,
great,
Steven.
Were you going to play
it
again?
You got cold feet, I understand.
In the middle, or whatever.
Cold feet, and you won't debate Sam. Why will you not debate Sam? But just to let you know, Sam is still up for it. All right?
I'm sad about this.
Just call Sam, it's the best. And you'll set something up. But... if Steven's dad won't let him debate you for some reason, Sam understands.
It's true. I do understand.
Listen, that's the status.
My folks have not weighed in on this, I want to say. But it's possible they would also be like, don't debate Steven. You know, don't. It'll be, you know, there's no reason to make him feel bad. And so we'll see. But Steven, I just want you to know that you don't have to do this just because Kevin Sorbo says to do it. Do it so that people who watch your show don't think that you're just looking for college students to debate with. Do it for yourself, Steven. Forget Kevin Sorbo. Forget Dad. Just do it for you. That's all I'm saying.
Forget Dad.
Easier said than done.
I know I've been critical of, what's his first name?
Anthony
Scaramucci. Because it's, you know, quite clear that after 2.5 years, he realized he was not getting back into the White House and said, well, how can I keep this, this celebrity train going? I know I will now become... a never Trumper, another wonderful never Trumper. And personally, I don't think he deserves the time of day, or at least I didn't think
I
he deserved
say,
the time
I don't
of
know
day
about that, dude.
Because Scaramucci, if he knows nothing else, he knows how to butter a guy up. And I don't know if he's fishing around for an interview on the show or what. I think we got pitched him a while back. But this goes a long way.
Let's do it.
Here is Anthony Scaramucci basically calling out Steven Crowder again. I can't believe it.
Good morning and happy Sunday. This is a message for Cold Feet Crowder.
Pause it for 1 second. Let's go back to the beginning. I just want to say, you know, for him to also to take time during his Sunday, he's obviously going out for a Sunday drive. You'll see in the video with his wife. She's great. Both of them are great. But I just want to say that
they really are.
I just want to say that's that I appreciate that. Noted. Just noted. Sunday.
He did the research.
Yeah.
Good morning and happy Sunday. This is a message for Cold Feet Crowder, and it got booked by Cinco Sanders. Okay, so listen up, Steven. Quit being a pussy and debate Sam. If you gotta ask Daddy for permission, it is what it is. And I know Sam ain't no teenager, but you gotta man up and do the right thing. Don't be a hack and a coward, Crowder. Debate Sam. The alpha males. The alpha males are back.
That is ridiculous. Men are ridiculous.
Okay, you hear my wife? My wife just said men are ridiculous, okay? Man up. Man up and debate the guy, okay?
It's true. It's true. I don't like it. I don't, I listen.
You gotta ask your dad, it is what it is. Right. Come on.
I, of course, being a soy boy, would have appreciated be a little bit less gendered. You know?
God.
Not just man up, but person up. But whatever, Anthony's going to deliver it in the way that he's going to deliver it. And So there you have it.
You got to ask
your dad.
His heart
was in the right place.
You got to ask your dad. It is what it is. That is for the ages.
Do you have, did I send you the clip of that thing? Gosh darn it. I noticed this, and I got to tell you, it's in the Slack. See if you can pull that up. It is an image, and I just want to say, look, this is not, here, I'll put it right in here, too. That's not it. Sorry, that's a different one. Here it is. This is in regards to Crowder. I noticed this. Now, you know, I don't know if somebody sent me this or if it came up on some type of feed or something, but pull this up. Apparently, there is a thing called, I just put it into the chat. There's a thing called, I don't know what they call this. It's some type of trend thing. Here it is. Yeah. And it's a gives tweet engagement stats. And here is the tweet that Steven Crowder did. Join us tonight, 8 p.m., 7 p.m. for the LWC live stream with Pinterest whistleblower Eric Cochran. I don't know what that means. And half Asian lawyer Bill Richmond. Good stuff. Very funny. This was on October 3rd, and there was these tweet engagement stats, and this I found pretty funny. The top hashtags in this tweet were 40% was the plurality, was Cold Feet Crowder. And then the top words, 33% debate, 20% Cedar. Let's see if there was any more top words. Oh, that's it. Okay. Sorry. So
can we watch the Scaramucci thing again?
Let's just watch the Scaramucci one more time. We're having fun here, folks.
Good morning and happy Sunday. This is a message for Cold Feet Crowder. And it got booked by Cinco Sanders. Okay, so listen up, Steven. Quit being a pussy and debate Sam. If you gotta ask Daddy for permission, it is what it is. I know Sam ain't no teenager, but you got to man up and do the right thing. Don't be a hack and a coward, Crowder. Debate Sam. The alpha males. The alpha males are back.
Oh, yeah. We're back, baby. We are back. The alpha males are back.
I know when he first got on the, Trump is unstable, needs to be removed from office train, we were all like, this is such a cynical play by a cynical person. But now...
I think he's a genuine play by a genuine guy.
Yeah, it's coming out. Let's go. We got a pretty fun segment coming up right now. Now, I want to be very careful here because there are... I've had two projects going on simultaneously that I have been waiting to unfurl for you. And they intersected at one point, and I'm not going to reveal the other project. It has been an ongoing project. Consistent listeners of this program have heard me reference it in other contexts, and we will get to that later. It's always best to roll these things out in the fall. However, the other project that I was working on seems to have basically unfurled itself.
Come to fruition.
Come to fruition. Now, as you know, or as you might imagine... Very often when progressive hosts go down to the commissary of their YouTube channels, they bump into each other. And or sometimes they just text each other and say, hey, what's up with this? Or are you doing this? Are you contemplating going to Politicon this year? Are you going to go to that conference? Hey, if you go, can I borrow your microphone or your lanyard? You have chats like that. Well, we've been going back and forth, I have been a little bit, with David Pakman. About a month or two ago, I received an email. And it was an invitation to go on to someone's YouTube show. And I don't know if it's a YouTube show, but it's a video streaming show. And now we get these type of things all the time. And sometimes I got to be honest with you, when we get, emails that purport to be offers, a lot of times I get a little bit suspicious. I'm not quite sure about this because we have times where, right-wingers like to, fish around and looking for stuff like this. And well, so we got this invite, and I will leave it there for a moment. Well, I should tell you right now, it was for the Gavin McGinnis show. And I will read from that now. Hold on. I'm trying to get that. Here we go. Bear with me. This is an email that we got, and I got actually two of them. I got one email from what purported to be... Shoot, what is going on? Oh, I know what it is.
Fuck you forever. That's my common quote I say. It's fuck you forever. We're done.
The that was not the email, but it was from the...
If that was the email, I would give nothing but props to Gavin McGinnis.
Here it is.
Have you guys... I'm pretty close to non-ironically using that, I think.
So
it's pretty good.
Back in May, we got an email. Hello, Sam Cedar team. My name is Jim, and I work for freespeech.tv. This is a new network being launched on June 1st. We were wondering if Sam would accept our invite to be on the show. The show is a panel discussion that will have a conservative and a liberal on every show to discuss the current events and politics for about an hour. The show is called Free Speech and will be hosted by Gavin McGinnis. Now, the line I'm about to read to you now, I don't know if you're going to appreciate how completely nuts this is to get an email like this. We can pay for Sam's travel and stay, plus pay him $5,000 to be on the show. We have a lot of big names on both sides of the aisle have agreed to be on. We're hoping Sam can do. We'll be filming two episodes a month for 12 months so we can work around Sam's schedule. Thank you, blank. Or Jim. Let's just call him Jim. Now, let me tell you something about getting offered $5,000 to do a show.
Available.
I went out to do Mark Maron's TV show a couple of years ago, called Marin. I did not make $5,000. I have been a paid contributor on MSNBC. I go on 4 to 5 times a month, some months 6 times, some months 3 times, something like that. I've never made anything close to $5,000 in 1 year. I mean, excuse me, 1 month. I don't know if I've made $5,000 in 6 months on MSNBC. So when someone offers me $5,000 to come do a 1 hour show that's going to air on YouTube or on some paid streaming thing, I'll tell you what I do. I think something's BS. And when something's BS around here, what we do is we send it over to Patrick. He is the producer, handles all the BS stuff. So Patrick went back and forth a little bit. and said, hey, Jim, can you tell me more deets? Where's it shoot? How long would Sam be required to be on location? Is this a cable show, YouTube show, makeup, etc.? Because Sam loves makeup.
Oh, if there's makeup, I'll be there.
I'll pass on the request.
Because I like makeup and money.
Hello, Patrick. Thanks for getting back to us. The show's being filmed in a professional studio in downtown Manhattan.
Like a cable.
There will be makeup. About 30 guests in the audience. The show will be shown on freespeech.tv, but putting up some interesting parts of the show on YouTube. Goes on to say that I saw Sam's interview with Glenn Greenwald the other day. It was really good. And we want the viewers from the right and left to be able to listen to both sides and not feel like they're growing. Gavin would be host of the show, and the two guests will be a liberal and a conservative on each show. And now I'll tell you what I'm thinking at this point. I don't want to be involved in something that is going to allow Gavin McGinnis to have some type of re-entry into the world of being able to host a show with, you know, people who walk amongst us. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't want to be involved in lending my credibility and just walk on a show with him. No, I'm not interested in that. Then they write, is there a particular conservative guest Sam would like to be on the panel with? We could make it work. Now.
Now we're getting interesting.
In now things are getting
to
interesting.
To make up in money.
Exactly.
Terrorizing an idiot.
Exactly. Now, this is part of the second project, so we're going to skip this. I was contemplating if they could deliver this person that I would do the show. I would not take any money for it because, as Michael said, the compensation would be coming from my being able to
appear.
Psychic
capital.
Exactly. And I will say this. The idea that I would go from Brooklyn to Manhattan for $5,000 is still bizarre. Like, I no way. I'm not taking that money.
Not everybody on the team thinks it's bizarre. Just put it out there.
Listen, I want to be clear about something.
I think it's pretty interesting, actually.
I want to be clear about something. Before you start thinking I have a tremendous amount of integrity here, I do have a price. And I said I would definitely do it for $250,000. And that stands. That stands. I would do it for $250,000. I'm sorry if
that is such a random number. Like, why that number?
That would dramatically implicate my life.
Okay. But that's just so, like, why, if you're going for a completely...
I would do it for $500,000, too. But I'm saying $250,000 or above.
That's just such an interesting... All right. So you what's amazing about your particular psychosis is I feel like you actually did... Like, the broader point is, I'm not going to do that. You know, because I don't feel comfortable with it. It doesn't feel good to me. And then you might say, like, eh, you know, $1 million. But you actually sat down and calculated.
No,
you're like,
I said,
no.
That's
with
exactly
precision,
how it happened. I said,
200.
I said, I'd do it for $1 million. And then I was like, you know what? I'd do it for $500,000. No, actually, I would do it for $250,000. I'm not going to do it for $200,000.
I can see you.
But I would do it for
$250,000. You're literally thinking, like, this would go into this account. This would be spread here. There would be a little bit of college planning action. And then when it's all said and done, I would take a vacation.
Yeah. I just.
That's great.
$250,000. Beautiful. I just wanted to be honest with myself. So, I mean, Patrick then basically hung back. And
it's incredible that Patrick has to deal with all
these
exchanges.
I know. Patrick.
Did you find him on ZipRecruiter?
Patrick, yes. We did find ZipRecruiter. So then he goes, then he writes back, I got some news. Roger Stone just committed for May 31st filming. And
Roger Stone is
would
not
you do it?
Necessary.
And so let's see. And then Patrick responded a little bit later. Hey, Jim, sorry to drop the thread on this. Sam was in and out over the past couple of weeks. he'd be really interested in appearing with blankety blank. Roger Stone did not seem interesting to him. And so...
this isn't the mid-1980s, Jim.
Jim wrote back, that's awesome, guys. We'll get that set up. We just had an awesome shoot with Dr. Cornel West and Milo. It was very civil and enjoyable conversation. I'll get some dates to you. I believe Gavin just reached out to blank yesterday for dates.
Wow.
Yep. And blank is on board for the show.
And Patrick's amazed now. Because
thank you, Patrick, and be in touch soon. And and then Jim writes back, what nights work in June for Sam? And Patrick wrote back, hi, Jim. Sam says whatever night blank is there works for him. Jim says, awesome. Thank you and back to you soon with dates. And then a couple of weeks go by. And Patrick writes back to Jim. Jim, Sam just asked what's up. Do we have a date yet? Jim said, thank you for following up. I'm sorry it's taking so long. I'm working hard on it, and we're in dialogue with it over with blank. I'll know more in coming days. And then a couple of weeks go by, and Patrick writes to Jim again. Hey, Jim, any word? Jim says, yeah, made some progress over the weekend. Hope to have an answer for you soon. I want this just as much as you and Sam want it. And then Jim wrote back a week later. We tried hard, man, but he just won't do it with Sam. Very disappointing. Is there
whoever
anyone else?
Whoever this other person is for the secret project, can I just say, they're a tremendous cuck.
Yeah. Is there anyone else that Sam might want to be on the show with? Just a couple ideas with Ann Coulter. What about Jimmy Dore? We've been talking with him.
Ann Coulter.
And
what is this?
Patrick writes back, oof. Oof. I'll ask him about the others. What happened with blank? He won't do your show or won't do it with Sam?
Now he
did
knows
he give
that,
a
now,
reason why? Sam's going to be cranky with me.
That was what I was going to say, is that now yeah. Patrick knows he has to deal with Sam's yeah. bullshit.
Yeah.
Sam's like, the one thing that was exciting for me for
exactly.
months
exactly.
not
when Patrick came
Patrick,
up to tell me this, God I was me. Livid. And so Patrick ended up writing back
sight,
2 days later. Hey, Jim. So now Sam thinks I messed up somehow on the blank thing. And that's why it's not happening. He didn't really react when I mentioned any of the other names. I can press him again, though.
Well, I mean, the other names are not that exciting.
And then Jim yeah. came back and laid out the whole thing, which we're going to save because that has more to do with the others. But finally, when I heard that this video we're about to play went down yesterday, I told Patrick, get in touch with Jim again. And he wrote, hey, Jim, sorry about the radio silence. That's a pun, folks. Sam didn't seem to want to talk about it after I told him about blank. But this morning he came in, and it was a big but, after a trip, and the first thing he asked was, who else they have and what's the best number they can do? Pretty sure he meant appearance fee. Parens, he was on a bit of a manic tear this morning, and I generally know better than get in the way of that. Sure, you can relate. Let me know. Signed, Patrick. And Jim said, no worries. I totally get it. And so our compensation package has a few things. A, that it's going to give Sam a bunch of exposure. And we would offer Sam a VIP town car pickup. We would drop off in the venue. Thirdly, we can offer $5,000 and free drinks at the bar. Yeah, there you go. And then he says, I think when blank sees the show with Sam, he's going to feel, quote unquote, one-upped. from Sam.
I think you might already feel that way.
Yeah.
I think that there might already be.
Well, all right. So here we go. And so it was only $5,000. It was not $250,000. Had it been $250,000, I got to be honest with you right now, I would not have done this video. But so here's the thing. What's clearly going on is someone either gave Gavin McGinnis a tremendous amount of money, like an extraordinary amount of money, and didn't care what Gavin did with it at all. Because to spend $5,000 on getting me as a guest down there, I've got news for you. Well, for Gavin, it would cost $250, but for you, I will do it on the phone more or less for free. But he desperately needs some lefties on his show to get back into the community in some way. To get back into the YouTube, like, to get back and be able to be seen as non-toxic.
The zeitgeist.
Into the zeitgeist. He just wants to be, he wants to get normalized. And so he also asked David Pakman. And had offered David Pakman, as far as I know, a similar compensation. And that was it. We were just strolling along, and then all of a sudden, somebody called in to David Pakman's show.
Okay, let's go next to our caller from the 253 area code. Who's calling today from 253?
Hey, David, it's Jim, and I just wanted to say, long-time listener, first-time caller, love you. And I just wanted to talk about the Green New Deal and just see what ideas you had about maybe getting that pushed through. And also, a guy I despise came up on my YouTube the other day on a commercial, Gavin McInnes, on this new show, Free Speech. And I was trying to click out of it right away, and then all of a sudden I saw Dr. Cornel West and Mark Lamont Hill on the show.
Yeah.
And I actually checked it out, and it's a cool show in regards to just liberals nailing Gavin, and it was so awesome to watch, especially Mark Lamont Hill. I canceled my subscription because I saw all the shows, but I just thought it'd be awesome if you could get on his show and destroy him for us.
So hold
please.
On. You canceled your subscription to what?
Oh, I signed up just to watch the Dr. Lamont Hill
I see.
Cornel
Listen,
West show
the
on the free speech.
I will have something to say personally that I'm involved with that affects me with regard to this new Gavin McInnes show at some point soon. Like I can't talk about it yet, but I'm going to have something to talk about related to it.
That is Pakman referring to the fact that he had been invited on this show. And continue.
Because I've had like a personal run-in with this program, and I think it'll be an interesting story.
All right, so that's it. And Pakman had that call last Friday, and over the weekend, people in the Reddit threads, I guess, said, that sounds a lot like Gavin McGinnis.
Certainly does.
And now, I know Gavin McGinnis. I've watched him on YouTube and whatnot, but I've hung out with him a couple of times years and years ago. And I have some good friends who used to be good friends with him. And I passed it on to those people. And they came back with, that sounds a lot like Gavin McGinnis. And Pakman cut a video yesterday where he was convinced that it was. Gavin heard from some, David heard from some other people, too, who were close in orbit with Gavin McGinnis, who said that sounds like Gavin McGinnis. Now, the name Jim, that also struck me as odd. What's with all the Jims in Gavin McGinnis's world? Now, here's one other element that you should know. Apparently, sometimes when people call you, they have caller ID. And these numbers, sometimes, if you Google them, they come up with something. David Pakman told me what the number was, and I took it and I put it into the Google machine. Now, I'm not going to say the name of this guy, but I will say his first name was Jim, And it turns out that he had run for office in 2017. He had run for, what was it, a county? I'm not going to say where the location was. What was it? Yeah, a county commission seat. And used over $100,000 of his own money. He had to withdraw from that seat because apparently he was on Twitter writing nasty things about black people. Very weird that this Jim has become liberal all of a sudden and wanted to see Gavin bashed by Mark Lamont Hill. Now, I have some speculation about the relationship between Jim, because maybe somebody wanted to use Jim's phone. Mm. Maybe Jim is actually a producer who's actually a fan of this show, even though he had that problem. I mean, who knows?
Let me just say that I'm not some, you know, overfed, comfortable, cushy Gen Xer. And I'm very offended that my guy Tom has not heard from this program. And I'm available for $50,000.
Oh, the guy who works for you, Tom?
Correct.
So there you have it. Gavin McGinnis is either getting money from a wealthy friend. I'll tell you this, Jim is only 37.
He's
only
right.
Yeah. To pay people to show up, and it's basically to whitewash him. Or it's possible Gavin's quite wealthy himself.
Hi, this is Jim. Do you want to spend my money in a totally reckless way?
The idea that he would call into Pac-Man's show to try and convince Pac-Man, and that was all to convince Pac-Man to go on, right? Mm. Please go on there and handle him. But that was pretty crazy. Let me just go to the phones. You're calling from a 353 area code.
Hello?
Hello? Where are you calling from? What's your name?
Am I on the program?
Yes.
Oh, great. I got through. This is Bob Fantella. First time, long time.
Bob Fantella. And where are you calling from, Bob?
I'm calling from the West Coast.
The West Coast?
The West Coast.
Okay.
I wanted to talk about why Donald Trump is like a racist.
Yeah, well, like
racist. But, yeah, like really, really bad. He's a racist.
Right.
But I was on the YouTube the other day, and you know how the algorithms are. And so this guy, I really hate him.
Yeah.
Right Wing Mandela came up as a recommended.
Right Wing
Mandela. And I guess he has this new show called Total Speech TV.
Total Speech TV.
Total Speech TV.
Mm-hmm.
And I was clicking off of it so fast, but then I saw that Atlantic contributing writer Peter Bidot was on. And so I clicked on, and Peter Bidot just destroyed him.
Oh,
it was Peter Bidot who is a contributor. He also edits the Forward.
Right.
It's a great progressive.
And
then Michael Isakoff was on too, and they just trashed them about all the topics. Anyways, I was wondering if you would consider going on Total Speech TV too
to
talk about, you know, to show that liberals are better and whatnot.
Right. To okay. So like so you were watching it with Isakoff
and Peter Bynot. Peter Bynot.
Really,
he's a contributing writer.
Mandela,
contributing
right?
writer yeah. for the Atlantic. Peter okay. Bynot.
Wow.
And he took Right Wing Mandela and he said, "No, you're wrong about 67 borders. You're yeah. wrong." And he owned him.
Wow.
Would you go on the program and own and dunk on Right Wing Mandela?
Well, I will do that. I mean, I got to say, you have quite a bit of an accent yourself, Bob.
Yes. Well, it's from where I grew up. I'm a person of color, which I know that you love. You're totally jazzed by that.
Right, that's right. That's true. Well, I will definitely put it under advisement. Thank you for the call.
Okay, looking forward, because if you could do what Isakoff did, then they would, he would be a heap on the floor.
I'm glad to hear
that. Okay.
Allahu
Akbar.
Thank you. Oh, God. There it is, folks. It only gets crazier. I will finish. I will end up putting those emails together, and we will go over those in a more cohesive way when we do the larger story here.
I subscribed and canceled, incidentally. Just so we didn't lose that beat. I watched Peter Biden and Michael Isikoff dunk on and own him, and then I clicked unsubscribe.
Unsubscribe.
Don't
yes.
want to watch any more of him. I tried doing that. I don't like him at all. I tried to click off, but the algorithm got me.
Let's go to the phones.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught.